It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with WPR favorites Norman Gilliland and Michelle Good about a live old-time radio drama staging of There's Always a Woman. It's coming soon to Minocqua and Oshkosh. First, WW, better known as Weight Watchers, sparked controversy last week after it unveiled its latest weight loss app, one that's aimed at children. The program is geared towards kids as young as 8, and the company said that the app, called Curbo, is based off of Stanford University research on childhood obesity. Weight Watchers says the app will help children cultivate healthy eating habits, but critics have argued that the app could have the opposite effect and make kids more stressed out about their bodies. Our next guest is here to talk about the app and how parents can have frank and honest conversations with their kids about health and wellness. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the vice president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navsaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with what your reaction was to the news that this weight loss, or as Weight Watchers says, wellness app, is aimed at kids in that age group.
Well, it's disturbing whenever we start to talk a lot about weight and body image and other issues like that in children of any age, certainly, but particularly on kids with kids as young as 8. We have enough messages in our society around body image that contributing to that sort of talk early is really problematic in many ways. This is not to say that obesity is not a concern and is not a genuine health concern, but the obsession with weight and appearance is really not where the emphasis needs to be.
So the company says that the app is based on research from Stanford University looking at that issue of childhood obesity. Do we know what kind of research Stanford is doing, and is this a good interpretation of what they may have found so far?
Yeah, so Stanford is using a model that's kind of a red light, yellow light, green light, which is nice because it's simple, and it encourages children and their families to think about foods that they can eat in larger quantities. Those are the green light ones, obviously, foods that they should eat only in very small quantities, like the red light ones and so on. The issue is that, as far as I know, that work has all been done in the context of larger comprehensive programs, goal setting, trained professionals working directly with children and their families and things like that. I think we all hope that if there's successful programs that are intensive, are there elements we can pull out? We actually see this in things other than obesity and eating and so on. We see it in literacy and other areas as well. The problem is we don't know if those things actually do anything standing on their own. And standing on their own, they may actually result in harm.
And you said that, you know, that kind of red light, green light, yellow light system is something that, you know, can work and can be a very easy concept to grasp. Do we know if kids are receptive to that kind of information? Or to me, like, a red light means stop. You know, it's not stop sometimes or, you know, stop most of the time. It's stop. It's putting a real value judgment on something.
It is putting a value judgment. And I don't know that we have great data on whether it works. Again, it's just a standalone on its own. I think if you've spent time as a child working with a trained professional who's really thinking about your overall health and wellness, then it can be a useful reminder of what that person has said and what you've discussed, and maybe connecting it back to your own motivations that are important, which you can't just easily do with an app that's out there.
And my understanding is that the basic form of Curbo is free, and it's just the app, but I believe it's about $70 a month if there's a coaching element involved. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're saying that this kind of system could probably work quite well if there is that element of the individualized coaching and interaction.
It could. And I don't know what the coaching looks like, nor have I seen any data or research to say if their specific coaching works. What we do know, what the research does show fairly well, is that multidisciplinary, meaning there's physicians involved and dietitians and exercise physiologists and so on and so forth, those individuals together with an app like this, with other coaching, maybe with text messaging, reminders, et cetera, those have been shown to work, and they actually have also been shown to not increase eating disorders, right? So that's, if a family asks me, what can I do here, that's actually where I'd want to send them. An app, well, not so sure if it works, and I also worry about the risk of harm. Teaching kids to start looking at everything that they're eating and logging it at a young age, I think has some significant problems and can very likely be the foundation for an eating disorder.
We're talking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria. He's a pediatrician at UW, and we are talking about a new app from WW that is the new name of what has been commonly known as Weight Watchers. It's an app that is geared towards kids as young as 8 and has them tracking what they are eating and how much. And Dr. Navsaria, I want to go back to something you said, the idea of eating disorders. I've also heard the term disordered eating. What do we know about where the line is between being conscious of what we're eating, quantity-wise, the quality of food, and it getting into a disorder?
That's an excellent question, and if I had a simple answer to that, I would tell you what it was. There's no one magic line that's there. I think certainly there's the clarity of when we know that when we see that individuals, whether it's adults or children, are doing things like making themselves throw up, or they are deliberately restricting their food intake, they're losing weight. I mean, that's obvious, right? Where's the line between that and being careful about what you eat? It's hard to know. I mean, there's also folks who are so excessively careful about, quote unquote, eating the right things that they are restricting themselves or restricting others around them, if in the case of parents who might be overly placing restrictions on their own children.
Certainly, obesity is an issue in the United States for both children and adults. And there are also different needs that growing bodies have than we might think of as, this is a right size, this is a too large a body size. What do kids need as they're growing to grow healthy? And does that sometimes look like maybe being overweight?
I think there's certainly a variety of dietary needs out there, and it depends on what's the child's activity level, what are their specific needs that are going on, and what age are they. These are so complex that I personally have a very low threshold for saying, let's have you see a dietitian. Because a dietitian can actually take into account all of those things, and a registered dietitian is trained in all of these areas and can think about it. We know that parents overestimate their children's activity levels. Oh, well, they're involved in soccer. And then if you actually go, okay, they're on the bench most of the time, they run around for a few minutes, and then everyone brings out the juice boxes and the cookies afterwards. And did we really burn anything? Or not really. So I think that quantifying activity, quantifying what else they're doing is important. Overall, with a diet, well-balanced, we tell people eat the rainbow, right, in terms of fruits, vegetables, things like that. And those are good basic ways to kind of approach what is healthy eating. And then the other emphasis really should be not so much on weight or appearance, but it should be on just overall wellness, on what are we doing to reduce your risk of health problems down the road.
And what are those ways that we can talk with children? As you mentioned, as we started our conversation, there are a lot of messages out there about what bodies should look like, what sizes are okay, and what sizes are not. I think there are probably parents who might be concerned about their children, about how much they're eating, how active they are or are not. But they're afraid of kind of pushing their kids over that line into disordered eating or an unhealthy obsession just by mentioning, maybe we could do this more or that more, or maybe you could eat a little less of that. Do you have some advice for those parents?
Yeah, I think that it is a difficult line of, and in parenting, as with many things, you're walking this tightrope. On one hand, you don't want your child to become excessively, overweight. On the other hand, you don't want to create an eating disorder. And gosh, that's such a hard one. And I speak not only as a pediatrician, but as a parent. I would say that keeping the focus away from things like appearance and weight, like that, what is the number on the scale, is a good idea. Instead, talking about overall well-being, how are you feeling, and also just avoiding things like diabetes and high blood pressure and whatnot down the road. Keeping the focus on that, on overall health, is a good one. Also because weight is actually not a great proxy in all circumstances. Someone can be quote-unquote overweight on the charts, but they could actually have a high amount of muscle mass. that's not the case for most people who are overweight, of course. But that's why when you go to a multidisciplinary clinic, they'll actually do other things to try to actually quantify body fat percentage versus muscle mass. And what's your overall fitness? You can actually be overweight, but actually be in great cardiovascular shape. And so on. So it's not super simple, but I say stay away from weight and appearance and think about overall health and well-being.
And I'm guessing that modeling active lifestyle and good eating, healthy eating would be a good step as well.
And it gets more powerful as your kids get older and they call you out for the things that you should be doing, that you've been saying that should be done, and they don't see you doing it. Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Tapesh Navsaria right now about a new weight loss app aimed at kids and the impact apps and conversations about weight and obesity can have on children. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of this app? If you have kids, how do you approach conversations about weight and health in your home? What do you think this app says about the current state of health in our country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about a new weight loss app that's aimed at children and the impact that can have on their well-being. Our guest is Dr. Tapesh Navsaria, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about an app like this? Do you think it could be helpful, or do you think it could harm how kids think about their bodies? What questions do you have about talking with kids about nutrition, weight, and health? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones, and Caitlin in Madison is up. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment was just, I really agree with all of the statements that your guest has made, and he's brought a lot of the conversation towards the complexity of diet in children and just focusing on their well-being. But I was wondering, I would think that this app could have a benefit for people who have maybe lower socioeconomic status or don't have good tools for really understanding good nutrition, and that maybe it would be a way to access that information without needing all of those extra team members that a family might not be able to afford.
Thanks for that call, Caitlin. So Caitlin saying that, you know, if it's identifying what are healthy foods, maybe that's some nutrition education for the whole family.
It certainly could. I would say if somebody's wanting basic information, irrespective of their socioeconomic status, there's excellent resources out there, including the American Academy of Pediatrics parenting portal, healthychildren.org. Many excellent articles on there. The other thing is that, interestingly, for folks who are in a lower socioeconomic status situation, if they're part of WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children program, which many are, they actually offer dietitian visits at many WIC sites. So actually access to that sort of expertise is not as far away as we might think.
Thanks for that call, Caitlin. One of the articles that I read about the app in preparing for our conversation, Dr. Navsaria, was a concern that kids are not in charge of doing the grocery shopping, especially the young ones. We're talking about 8, 9, 10 years old. They really don't have any control over what is available in their house to eat. And while maybe they can say, hey, you know, hey, mom, hey, dad, can we get some more vegetables? Can we get some more fruit? They might be told these are the good things to eat, but those might not be the things at home. How do you see that maybe playing out?
Yeah, certainly. They're not the ones that are doing the final choices on the grocery shopping. And this often, you know, I'm talking to families about their child's eating habits and what they are or are not eating. And often it comes back to what are the parents eating? You know, so if the parents aren't modeling good eating and if they're not making good healthy choices available, well, it's very hard for a child who's in that environment. I will say that fairly young kids do actually drive a lot of decisions, though, and this is why food marketing is such a problem. Very young children, there's not a good reason to have cartoon characters on cereal boxes except to entice children to make the demand to purchase that. You'll see cartoon characters, licensed characters on breakfast cereal. You won't see it on an apple so often. They're doing a little of that, but still.
I want to talk a little bit about the ages that we're looking at here. This app is geared towards kids as young as 8. They do have to have parental permission to sign into the app up until 13. Mm-hmm. Puberty can start definitely before 13, but there are a lot of kids who might be in puberty, are signing into this. Their parents might not even know they're on this. And that's a time when the body's going through a lot of development. What's happening at puberty, and how might that show itself in a changing body?
Yeah, certainly in puberty, there's a variety of things that are happening. We're seeing growth spurts, especially in males, but also in girls happening as well. There's hormonal changes that affect the distribution of fat throughout the body that are all perfectly normal types of things. So things that might actually not have anything to do with one's food intake, what they're eating, how they're eating, can actually cause changes. And the question then becomes, well, is this a problem? Is this not a problem? And a child may not know. This app is just kind of going blindly, kind of, you know, this is the advice it's going to dispense. It has no way to calculate whether you're going through puberty. It also has no way to read your emotional state. It can't tell if you're crying about what your weight is doing. Right, it's really largely one way, even though it's touted as interactive. It's not the same as a trained professional who can empathetically respond to what your concerns are, your motivations, and things like that.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. Mary in Greendale is up. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just had a question. When it is a situation where people may have some socioeconomic issues, how do they actually go out and afford to buy healthful food? When, if you were to consider the cost of a $1 cheeseburger at McDonald's is cheaper than buying 4 pears at the grocery store.
Thanks for that, Mary. Another aspect of this is definitely the socioeconomic aspect.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head there. That are you know, we could get into a whole conversation about agriculture and how cheap it is to purchase fast food because of how we subsidize things and so on. I think that that's a piece of it. Let's also remember that programs like WIC specifically aim at offering nutrients that are typically missing from the diet of American women, infants, and children. So they are offering healthy food. There are programs that have, you know, increased accessibility and actually doubled benefits for at farmers markets and things like that to act as an incentive there. So all of that plays into it. I will say that the second piece of this, though, is not just affording, it's knowing what to do with it. How do you cook healthy food? How do you make fruits and vegetables taste good? They don't have an easy label on them with one preparation method like something that's processed in a box. So it's not just the knowledge gap and the cost gap. It's also a skills gap that we need to be able to address.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We are talking about a new weight loss app that is geared towards kids. And let's go back to the phones. And AC in Monroe is up. Hi, AC.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey. I think the app is perfectly fine. I think, you know, me personally, with my kids, I have a whole lead by example kind of thing. You know, they want to do what I want to do. I started running, they started running, you know. And I think the app is a cool way for, like, you know, with the technology of today to kind of, like, integrate our technology with the things that we do in life, because I think that's what technology is there for. So I feel like, you know, as a parent, you know, just have those healthy behaviors, do those healthy things, you know, let them watch what you're doing instead of, like, imposing what you will. And I think if the app is to work in conjunction with that, like, is there an equivalent adult app that goes with it that, like, hey, they see me on that app, you know, they can jump on the equivalent version of theirs, you know? So I think it's an actual helpful tool.
Great. Thanks for that call, AC. Dr. Navsaria?
Yeah, and I think what you're saying actually is exactly the point, that the central piece of your kids being healthy is you, is your behaviors, your messaging, and all that. Would they be fine without the app? We don't know that. That research isn't there. But what we are saying is that the app on its own, or the app out of that context, we're not really sure what good it may do, and we're actually concerned that there may be harm.
So let's talk, especially at that really young age, like 8 years old, and we do know that that kids that age are aware of what body image is expected. They're conscious of it. What are some of the messages, positive messages, that we can give young kids about their bodies?
So I think there's a few things. One is certainly starting good eating habits from a young age is key. Avoiding kind of the constant snacking that may be necessary with a toddler because of how quickly their stomachs do empty, but isn't so necessary in the late preschool and early school age, the sort of a snack culture that's developed of, oh, we need to feed kids constantly. Making sure that they understand how to read signals from their own body about hunger, like what it is to actually be hungry. Sometimes kids say they're hungry, and what they mean is I'm bored, but they don't have the ability to express that yet if they're younger. So I think all of those things definitely play into it. And then I think, again, having the conversation being about enjoying food and not necessarily treating I'm stuffed or I'm full as equivalent to being enjoyment. That can happen, right? Holiday meals, et cetera, right? That's okay. That's an occasional thing. But staying away from that, I'm stuffed means I've enjoyed this versus, wow, this was really good.
And I'm guessing we start those conversations early and we just keep having them.
Exactly.
Dr. Navsaria, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He joined us today to talk about a new weight loss app that's aimed at children. It's called Curbo. It's from Weight Watchers, which is now called WW. And you can continue the conversation by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. What do you think of an app like this? Do you think that it could be useful in conjunction with talking with your kids and modeling good behavior? Or are you concerned that it could get kids too obsessed with what they're eating and how much, what their body looks like and how thin or not they are? And you can tell us what you think. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, old-time radio has an ageless quality. We'll chat about the live staging of There's Always a Woman by WPR's 9XM Players. We'll talk with Norman Gilliland and Michelle Good. That show is coming to Minocqua and Oshkosh. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Planned Parenthood announced this week that it would forego Title X federal funding. That's in response to a new rule from the Trump administration that would ban the organization from making referrals for abortion. However, Wisconsin Planned Parenthood clinics have been without federal funding for the better part of this year. We'll learn what impact that's had on healthcare in the state. First, radio dramas and comedies captivated millions before TV took over as the preferred entertainment medium. And while its influence may have declined, even today there are those who enjoy and seek out stories told by radio that allow for the imagination to fill in the blanks and enhance the experience. WPR not only provides weekly opportunities to hear the old offerings again, our 9XM players also give live audiences around the state the opportunity to not just see a production, but to be part of the fun. Norman Gilliland is host and producer of old-time radio drama, and Michelle Good is a jack-of-all-trades around WPR and director of the 9XM Players. Michelle, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks so much, Judith.
And Norman, great to see you as well.
My pleasure, Judith.
So, Norman, when was the golden age of radio dramas?
There are two answers to that, both of them pretty short. You could say now, while the 9XM players and so many other groups around the country are producing radio plays. But historically speaking, you can define it pretty neatly from 1932 when a lot of the mainstream dramas and comedies came on. And 1962 would be at the other end when the last of the mainstream radio plays ceased production.
And Norman, how long have WPR listeners been able to enjoy rebroadcasts from that era?
Well, in my watch, I can't say about before that, but we started September 3rd, 1989, been at it ever since.
Wow. So you've got a 30-year anniversary coming up.
That's true.
And Michelle, what do you think it is about these stories that hold up for today's audiences?
Well, they're universal. I mean, most of them, if it's a mystery, everybody is familiar with mysteries, and that basically hasn't changed. The thing about them that keeps them fresh is they were timely and political in their time, and a lot of that holds up. The humor holds up. Some of the things, the situational comedies, life hasn't changed that much from a humor point of view.
There are some things that have changed, how we talk about things like gender and race. How do you address those issues when you're considering either airing it, Norman or Michelle, if you're doing a stage play?
Do you want to take the airing part?
The airing part, yeah, is something that changes over the course of time as the bar, you might say, moves. And so I just try to be aware of, sensitive to those changes. And sometimes listeners will give me, what shall we say, updates as to what is proper and what is not. And sometimes we'll trim things out and sometimes we'll just take entire shows out of the repertory.
And Michelle, what about doing it for stage?
Well, for the live shows, the major change is we take the language and just sort of adjust it to the times. For example, in the one we're doing, there was a series of lines where he was sort of berating her. I think at the time it was more of a husband and wife banter teasing. You would read it now more as like, boy, he's not supportive. He's almost borderline abusive. So we changed the line where he literally said something along the lines of, why did I ever marry you? And she said, I don't know. And he said, well, I'm stuck with you now, kind of thing. And we just smoothed it a little to say, why did I ever marry you? And she's like, because you love me. And he goes, yeah. So just to sort of sweeten it a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Michelle, what's the appeal for you to stage some of these dramas or comedies from so many years ago?
To see them come to life is amazing. Hearing them, you hear all the laughter. Half the time you don't understand what they're laughing about because it isn't actually in the lines. It's what the actors were doing. We get a chance to bring that back to life and not only what they were originally intending, but then take it to a whole nother level of our interpretation of it. It's really fun. And to see it become this time period as opposed to that time period, to freshen it in that way, it's really exciting. It does bring life back into the whole thing.
What are some of the challenges?
Some of the challenges are rewriting things. You run into things where once an actor is performing it, all of a sudden it takes on an entirely different meaning than reading it just flat in a script. With the live shows, I think one of the challenges we've definitely overcome is people come in expecting to see us reading scripts, standing there very statically, and we've found a way to really give you a whole play, blocked, moved, props, everything,
and but still
yet
hang on
still
to the scripts.
Having a radio show. Yeah. I mean, it's this really interesting hybrid that we've been able to create all on our own. The actors love it. The audiences really go crazy for it.
Norman, I think the concept of sound effects for radio performances grabs a lot of people's attention and imagination. What are some of the ways that you create that atmosphere and help listeners visualize what's going on?
Well, the prime example in this production coming up is Fibber McGee's Closet, which was one of the most famous sound effects in all of radio and a running gag that went on for years. And we just happened onto the 1940 script, which has the debut, so far as anybody knows, of that sound effect. And it's just, you can imagine the richness of this stuff coming out of this closet.
So
this,
it's a packed closet. Overstuffed closet that gets opened and everything
piles
out. That's
right. And it sounds different every time, but it's an absolute catastrophe. And
it goes on and on and on.
And our version of it is fun to watch and it's fun to listen to.
Yeah. And Steve Gotcher, who's our Foley artist for this show, not only does he have a blast performing it, but he had a blast just putting the whole concept together. We're talking with Michelle Good right now, jack of all trades around WPR and director of the 9XM Players, and Norman Gilliland, host and producer of old-time radio drama. We are talking about their current live stage production of There's Always a Woman. And let's talk about that show. Michelle, what is it based on?
Well, it is based on a short story, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
From the 30s that was adapted by Orson Welles for the Campbell's Playhouse.
And in between, there was a movie.
And ours is based kind of on all three.
Okay. And what's the plot?
Well, who knows? I mean, it's such a screwball comedy mystery that it's hard to follow. But the premise is that this young wife of a district attorney becomes an amateur detective. And is she competent or is she incompetent and lucky? And it all kind of hinges on that. It's a lot of kind of husband-wife rivalry on the one hand. And, oh, by the way, there was a murder in there somewhere.
I think a lot of people would assume that you will give me the same answer to both parts of this question, but I know that's not true. I want to know how many performers there are and how many characters there are.
There are 5 actors and there are 32 characters.
And how does that work, Michelle?
It's fun. It's fun to watch. It's fun to do. But each character has a distinct vocal characterization, pitch, sometimes accent. And then we take it another step where we do physicality, too. So between costumes and physical posturing and how they carry themselves, the characters change. Some of the most fun things, and I actually blocked the show, arranged the show to visually take the best advantage of this. There are times when one actor is playing 2 characters who's arguing with himself or interrogating
himself.
They're
surprisingly good at it. It's a little scary, actually.
Well, let's hear a little bit of There's Always a Woman.
Those are quality folks at the next table.
They're not quality folks. I bet they're just as unimportant as you and I.
For your information, Mrs. Reardon, they are people that anyone who wants to be a detective ought to know at first sight. They are Walter and Lola Fraser.
Faber?
F-R-A-S-E-R,
Fraser. I get it.
The other man, it's Jerry Marlowe, transcontinental copper. And the girl's Anne Calhoun. You've heard of Anne Calhoun. She's engaged to Marlowe, but...
Oh, there you are, going off again, Bill Reardon. I don't think you know anything about them.
Sally, please keep your voice down.
Oh, I'm not talking half as loud as they are.
So that sounds like a lot of fun, and you can hear the audience there in the background.
Yeah. We actually, the show grew by, what was it, like
12 minutes. When we did it in Racine, it was like an hour 36 when we ran it, you know, in the dress rehearsal, and it ran an hour 48 in Racine because we couldn't believe it. Well, we can now, of course. There was so much laughter and applause. It was a real party.
So you have shows coming up in Minocqua. That's tomorrow night, and then in Oshkosh in October.
October 11th, I believe.
And what will audience members get from being there in person for those performances?
Well, all those visuals that Michelle talked about, the people changing character on a turn of a dime, and all of the action and the facial expressions, and you get to see the Foley artist, too.
Yeah, and lots of slapstick. It's very, we call it a madcap comedy. It really is. I mean, there's a frenetic between all these actors, like, trying to fit in all these parts and running off stage and changing clothes, and there's a real frenetic energy to it that is not captured on radio.
And how can people get information about those upcoming performances?
They can go to WPR.org/presents, and there's information on both shows there.
And obviously, it would be great if people could go to Minocqua or to Oshkosh, but is there a way that they can hear the show if they can't make it in person?
We did record the one from Racine that is on the WPR
archive on the Old Time Radio page. Also, at each show, we do make a recording and try and get it up so people can go back and listen to themselves.
So can we ask you to tell us what the 9XM players might take on next?
Well, in January, the end of January, we're doing a small show here from hopefully Buck, our remodeled Buck Studios.
Two short ones.
The Plotters and Plan X, which is sort of science fiction, outer space,
love story. versus a couple of bumblers trying to get rid of their wives.
Oh, something for everyone.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Norm and Michelle, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
A pleasure.
Michelle Good wears many hats at WPR, including director of the 9XM Players, and Norman Gilliland is host and producer of old-time radio drama. You can learn more about and get tickets for There's Always a Woman at WPR.org/presents. The Minocqua Show just sold out, but there are still tickets for Oshkosh. Coming up, Planned Parenthood announced that it will refuse federal funds this year. We'll learn how this will impact Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Under a new bill in the state legislature, brick-and-mortar stores would be required to accept cash payments. Coming up, we'll talk with the plan's sponsor about how it would work and why he's calling for a ban on cashless transactions. First, Planned Parenthood announced that it would refuse roughly $260 million in federal Title X funding. That's following a rule from the Trump administration that prevented doctors and employees from discussing abortion with patients. According to the Associated Press, since the national organization made the announcement, several clinics in various states have had to start charging for certain services and dip into emergency reserves. But here in Wisconsin, Planned Parenthood clinics have actually been without Title X funding for most of 2019. Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. She joins us to talk about the impact of the lack of Title X funds on Planned Parenthood sites in the state and why those clinics lost the funding. Corrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us an overview? Why did Wisconsin Planned Parenthood lose the funding earlier than this point we're at now?
Well, in 2016, the legislature passed a law requiring the state's health department to compete with Planned Parenthood for the federal Title X funding. And when they did that, the state got the funding. And so that went into effect in 2019. And so Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin no longer gets their Title X funding, and that was $3.5 million for Planned Parenthood.
And so this change in state law that made the funds competitive, what was the rationale given by lawmakers at the time for that change?
Lawmakers did not want those federal dollars to go to any clinics that provide abortions. The Title X money, though, did not go to abortions. Title X funds were created years ago, about 50 years ago, and they're used to provide women, men, and teens with things like birth control, STD testing, cancer screenings. But the Republicans, state Republicans, felt like that money just did not belong with clinics that did offer abortion services.
So it sounds like they were saying, you know, even if the money isn't going directly for abortion services, if the Planned Parenthood clinics don't have to use, quote unquote, their own money to provide these other health care services, then in effect, it's still freeing up money to be used for abortion services.
That's exactly right.
So the funding became a way of getting money through a competitive process. Which organizations did Planned Parenthood lose funding to this year?
So that's the thing. Right now, the state health department got the money. They ended up getting $3.8 million in March. And in talking to them, they're still trying to figure out who should get the money. The state law directs it to go to the state, county, and local health departments first. And then any remaining funding could go to hospitals or federally qualified healthcare centers. Those centers provide care typically for patients who don't have insurance. But I think the state is still trying to allocate that, and they're coming up with a plan right now.
When was this bill originally passed that made this a competitive granting process?
So it was originally passed in 2016, but they did not apply for the funding again until, the grant didn't wear out until the end of 18. So they weren't affected until this year.
And did you reach out to the lawmakers who were behind that bill from a few years ago?
I did. I reached out to a handful of lawmakers, and they all still stand behind it. And they said that the National Planned Parenthood's decision this week to withdraw from Title X, you know, reinforces that that Planned Parenthood really puts abortion as a top priority. So lawmakers, again, said that they stand behind this decision and that they are happy that the money is going to health departments and hospitals that don't perform these services.
So that's their interpretation of Planned Parenthood's action. What has Planned Parenthood said?
Well, Planned Parenthood has said that this is a political maneuver and that, you know, the money was never used for this. But they also pointed out that in doing all of this politics, the people are lost in the mix. And Planned Parenthood was serving 31,000 patients across the state with the Title X program. And these are patients who don't have insurance or come from a very low income households. So, I mean, Planned Parenthood has made it very clear that their doors will remain open to the patients, but they are trying to find the money elsewhere to serve them.
We're talking with Corinne Hess right now. She's a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. And she's talking with us about her article about the impact of the lack of Title X funds on Planned Parenthood sites in the state. And how much, as we said, this has been a few months now that Wisconsin Planned Parenthood clinics have not had access to this particular funding stream. Do we know what they have been doing to make up that shortfall?
You know, they didn't really give me the details about what they're doing, but they did say that it has been a struggle. And, you know, they pointed out, too, that one in every five women in the state has used Planned Parenthood. And the thing is that Planned Parenthood has really become a lightning rod for the abortion debate. But a report by a national institution that I should say does support legalized abortion showed that there's been a 21% decrease in the abortion rate in Wisconsin between 2011 and 2014. So of Planned Parenthood's clinics, there's 24 of them. Only three of those provide abortions statewide.
And what are the other services that they do provide that, for instance, that 21% drop in the abortion rate might be attributable to?
Well, Planned Parenthood provides a host of services. Like I mentioned before, they provide birth control. They do STD testing. They do cancer screenings. So they do a lot of different things in addition to the abortions.
As you mentioned, Corey, there are a lot of people who have made Planned Parenthood quite a lightning rod in this issue of abortion. What have you heard from the anti-abortion movement leaders in response to this news?
Well, actually, it was just what you said earlier, that that what Planned Parenthood does is move around the federal funding that is not intended for abortion, and they instead then that frees up money to be able to hire people to perform more abortions.
Other than those Planned Parenthood clinics that provide some providing abortions, all of them providing other reproductive health care, what's kind of the next layer of services that are available? 24 Planned Parenthood clinics, but are there comparable outlets for people to get the same or similar services?
You know, like I said, there are federally qualified healthcare centers across the state. There aren't a ton of them, but there are some. I know in Milwaukee, we have four of them. So there are services that are provided for low-income people or people without insurance.
And do we know anything about that's what's available, but do we know how accessible they are in terms of, say, waits or being where the people are who need these services?
Again, I'm just speaking from the Milwaukee area, but they're scattered. The four are around the city. So they are accessible.
What do you expect will be a next step in this issue? Is there a next layer to this debate that you expect to see coming down the pike?
Well, I mean, this happened in Wisconsin in 2016. They lost the money in March. So I think that the debate is closed here. I think the next steps for Planned Parenthood, like I said, they are keeping their doors open. They're committed to serving their patients. So, I mean, I believe their next steps are just finding the funding any way they can to keep serving their patients.
And briefly, Corey, before we let you go, this is, of course, a different governor in place. Have we heard anything from that administration on this?
No, I have not spoken to the governor.
All right. Well, Corey, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. She joined us today to talk about Wisconsin branches of Planned Parenthood being without federal funding for several months already. That's in light of its parent organization refusing federal Title X money this week after the Trump administration implemented a gag rule that prevents doctors from making referrals for abortions. Corey's article about that can be found on WPR.org. If you were a TV watcher in the mid-1980s, you may remember this Geraldo Rivera stunt.
Scarface Al Capone may have built it, and nobody knows what's in it. Some say money. Some say bodies. Some say it's booby trap, and we're going to open it. What secret lies inside? It may be Scarface Al Capone's biggest secret, and we'll open it on live television. Step inside the vault with me on April 21st.
Yep. Geraldo opened what was thought to be Al Capone's secret vault on live television, and there was nothing in it except some garbage. Lots of buildup, no payoff. Fast forward to this week, and residents of Derry, New Hampshire were excited to open a time capsule from 1969. It was a small, unopened safe that had been sitting on a dusty shelf in a town library. Now, since astronaut Alan Shepard was a native of Derry, some hoped that there would be some cool space memorabilia in it. Others had heard that a film reel of a driving tour of the town had been included, which would have been fun to see. The safe was set to be opened this Saturday at nearby Londonderry's Old Home Day celebration, but the library director decided to crack it open early to see what was in it. Turns out, nothing. It was completely empty. They don't know if the contents were removed at some point or if it was just closed up empty. At least they didn't have to deal with the public letdown like Geraldo did. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.